Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Tara Miller, and this is Joan Rivers.
When I was 21, my mother said, only a doctor for you. When I was 22, she said, all right, a lawyer, CPA. 24, she said, we'll grab a dentist. 26, she said, anything. If he could make it to the door, he was mine, you know? What do you mean you don't like him? He's intelligent. He found the bell himself. What do you want?
That was a bit from The Ed Sullivan Show in 1967. And our whole show this week is about relationships, the classic kind and then the unexpected kind. Historian Stephanie Kuntz has said that marriage was once thought of as the master status. But now we're making more and more important decisions outside the bounds of marriage. We're having kids, we're buying homes, and there's also a spike in divorces amongst people in their 50s and 60s, so we're now rethinking retirement without a spouse. Stephanie is here to talk about where marriage is headed and where it's been. She's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State and the author of The Way We Never Were. We're also joined by Sharon Sassler, a professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell. Thanks to both of you for being here.
My pleasure.
Mine too.
So, Stephanie, I want to go way back here for a second because you've pointed out, and I think this would be surprising to a lot of people, that hundreds of years ago, the notion that love should be a part of marriage, that whole concept of loving your spouse, that was foreign to people.
Foreign and profoundly disturbing. It's funny because a lot of what we think of as traditional marriage was really a very recent invention. And a lot of things that we think of as recent inventions like cohabitation actually were fairly common in long parts of the past. But yes, this notion that we think is central to marriage, that marriage is about the free choice of two individuals on the basis of finding a partner that they love, was for thousands of years antithetical to the notion of marriage. Marriage was about political alliances, about economic peace treaties, military treaties, gaining more money, above all, gaining advantageous in-laws. It was more about the interests of the parents than the young people.
I love the notion that marriage was really about your in-laws.
Well, yes, today we see in-laws as sometimes disruptive to marriage, but they were the original purpose of marriage.
And Stephanie, when did that change, that notion that love shouldn't be a part of marriage? When did people start saying, yeah, it's a great thing if you love the person you marry?
Well, young people have always dreamed of marrying someone they could love, but it was so unrealistic that that's why most of the great love stories of history were tragedies. Only in the 18th century, especially in the West, as you got the divides of a market economy and men and women could go out and earn wages rather than wait for a dowry or to inherit the land, it became more possible to defy your parents. And then on top of that came the great middle-class revolutions of the 17th and 18th centuries, the Enlightenment, the ideal that the older generation and the state shouldn't dictate to the young, the American Revolution, that people have a right to the pursuit of happiness, and gradually this radical idea that shocked conservatives of the day began to spread. You have a right and eventually even a duty to marry someone you love and not to marry someone you don't. It was a very radical idea.
Sharon, when you look at how the demographics of marriage have shifted, like who's getting married and how those marriages are working out, maybe just over the last 25 years, what jumps out to you as the biggest trend that you see?
Well, the biggest trend is that the college educated are far more likely to be getting married than are those with less than a college degree. Mm. And it seems like we are creating this idea of marriage as a luxury good. So whereas, the majority of adults used to enter into marriage, now it seems like you have to wait until you have all your ducks in order. And there are a lot of ducks to get in order if you need to finish your schooling and you have to have saved money. And increasingly, people talk about buying a home before they get married. So what's been happening in the last 15 to 20 years is that it's the college educated who are the most likely to be married and stay married. that is a little bit different because it used to be the case that if women went on to get a college degree, they were somewhat less likely to marry, in part because they had a job and they were more economically independent. But
right.
Now the most economically independent women are also the most likely to be married, and they tend to marry men who, like them, have a college degree or more. And what we also see is that it's college-educated men also who are doing more with children. I have a paper that's forthcoming with Dan Carlson, Amanda Miller, and we in fact find that couples where men do a larger proportion of the domestic chores are the only couples that have experienced an increase in sexual frequency over the last 20 years, and they are more happy with their sexual relationships. So traditional couples have experienced a decline. Couples where men actually do the majority of the housework have also experienced a decline in sexual frequency. I don't know if people know this, but overall around the world, there's been a decline in sexual frequency from the 70s and 80s. So it is interesting to see, well, among which couples has it actually increased? And we find that it's significantly greater if we look at this sample of moderately educated couples in the early years of the 21st century, if men are sharing the load more equally.
And Stephanie, I'll just give you a crack at that. What does that say to you?
Well, I think that when you look at the past, and I've studied, taken a lot of oral interviews with women in marriages of the 50s and 60s, and they may have reported or even had more sex, but it was often because they felt they had to, that they were obligated. So I think that Sharon's finding is extremely important, that when women don't feel obligated and compelled and guilty all the time, or that this is the only way they'll keep their marriage going, then what really works for them is when the man is man enough to step up to the plate and do housework and childcare, and that's a real turn on.
But Stephanie, when Sharon talks about the money component of marriage, it sounds like she's describing marriage as something that has a price tag, essentially. Does that feel to you like a real break from the past?
Well, it has a different price tag. Marriage has always had a price tag. And one of the reasons that marriage was very stable in the 1950s and 60s was that women had absolutely almost no alternative outside marriage. Men's wages were rising very, very rapidly. Their real wages at all income levels were rising. By 1961, the average man in his late 20s was making four times as much as his father did. That sort of gave him an incentive to support a family. And his wife's real wages were flat completely, or the woman's real wages. So the only way that the woman could participate in that prosperity was to get married and to make most of the accommodations necessary to stay married. So the difference is not that money and financial considerations are involved, but that now there's a very interesting different trade-off. First of all, most couples do need two incomes. So men as well as women are looking at the earnings power of their partners, which is a real disadvantage for low-income men and women both. But in addition to that, because we have these higher expectations and because there are options outside marriage for people, back in the 1950s, the average couple married after knowing each other only 6 months, and it really wasn't a major problem for their marriages because they were just marrying another gender role and it was essential to keep going. Today, that doesn't cut it anymore.
You know, I feel like so much of what we talk about now, whether it is medicine changing or the workplace changing or marriage changing, you know, and sort of where all these things are headed, you come back very often to this issue of, well, the way it's changing is very different for people who are high income versus people who are low income. You know, maybe things are changing and maybe things are getting better, but not everybody has access or is living in that universe. Does it worry you, Stephanie, that you've got people who are wealthier marrying at higher rates and marrying each other so that money marries money and doesn't necessarily get spread around?
absolutely worries me. And I completely share Sharon's concerns and love the work that she's done, for example, on why cohabitors move in too quickly because of financial pressures and then may not be able to find the best match. But it's very interesting to see that we have made real progress across the board in terms of people's attitudes. And even for low-income people, there have been major improvements. Domestic violence rates have been falling. Child abuse has been falling. But unfortunately, at the same time as we've seen more motion toward gender equality, we've seen an extremely accelerated motion toward greater socioeconomic inequality that puts huge pressures on the new kind of relationships that most people want. And the result is this widening gap in access to stable, rewarding relationships that worries me dreadfully.
Sharon, let me dip into a piece of research that Stephanie mentioned. You found that people who want to live together, not get married, but just live together, they're moving in too quickly?
That's true. So one of the ideas is that cohabitation would weed out the poorest quality relationships. It also takes you out of the partner market, generally. And cohabitations are lasting longer than they used to, in part because it's also expensive to break up. You need to find another apartment, right? So, I mean,
it's expensive to get married and expensive to break up.
Yeah.
It's a catch-22 situation.
And some of the cohabitors that I've interviewed say it's less expensive for them to end a cohabitation than to get a divorce. But the research does show that people who cohabit repeatedly are more likely to divorce when they do get married. So there are risks to thinking of cohabitation as just a new form of dating.
I wonder this from both of you, but Stephanie, I will start with you. If you had to sort of guess what's going to happen, what the trends feel like to you in marriage, where do you see things going?
Well, you know, historians hate to be asked questions like that because so much of these questions depend upon what we do now. We've got two things going on here that could end up in very different directions. One is this increase in egalitarianism, which I think is extremely significant. We find that women who have more education than their husbands, no longer a threat to divorce. There's tremendous progress here in terms of the values that people have, but their inability to act on them and the pressures that force them to violate them and move back from them often are coming from primarily the economic sphere and also here in America from the political sphere. The fact that we're the only wealthy industrial country that doesn't have any decent work-family policies. And only 13% of Americans have paid parental leave. And of course, it's always those at the top that Sharon was talking about. So the big question is, are we going to build upon the gains that we've seen in the past 25 or 30 years and allow people, give people the space and time, which our rich country is certainly capable of doing, to nurture these relationships and not have to rush into things? Or are we going to keep ramping up this economic pressure that is continually tearing down the kinds of strong relationships that people would like to build?
So Sharon, let me go back to the question I asked Stephanie, which is, when you look at the trends that you've been seeing over the past few decades, where do you feel like marriage is headed? Are fewer people going to get married, or what sort of shape will it be in 20, 30 years?
Sociologists, I think, are a little more willing to guess, to estimate what the future
Fantastic.
Will hold than historians, right? So I think that there is this belief that a sizable proportion of the American adults will marry and continue to get married in their future, but it will increasingly be more of an elite institution. What we hear from less educated and less advantaged individuals is that they still value marriage and aspire to it someday. The question is whether they will get there, whether the things that they believe need to be in place will enable them to take that step. A lot of that depends, though, on the economic circumstances that they experience when they're young adults, when they're in the prime marriage ages.
A final question here about one of the biggest changes to marriage, I think unquestionably in the last couple of decades. the legalization of same-sex marriage across the country. How has that changed how people think about marriage in America?
I think that it has had far fewer effects than opponents were frightened of. You know, when it first started, you got people like James Dobson saying, oh my gosh, if you legalize same-sex marriage, it will revolutionize the way marriage has been for 5,000 years. And my response to that has been, one of the reasons that it's on the verge of being legalized is because we have already revolutionized the way marriage was for 5,000 years. I mean, just think about it. You know, for thousands of years, it was not about love. So, of course, why should you give people the choice to marry whom they love? And then in the first draft of what I think of the love match in the 19th century, they were so afraid of the destabilizing aspects of the love match that they really downplayed sexuality. And sexual attraction was not considered to be a really important part of it. A good woman didn't feel that. It was only in the early 20th century that we added the idea that, oh, well, marriage should also be about sex, you know, and sexual attraction. So that was kind of the first opening of the door that said, well, maybe people should then be allowed to marry someone of the same sex. But that still seemed unreasonable to people because marriage wasn't a right. It wasn't a right not to have children in marriage. And in fact, artificial insemination was ruled as adultery by courts in the 1950s, so you couldn't have that. So when heterosexuals won the right, A, not to have children if they didn't want them, and B, to have children if they weren't biologically capable, there's the next crack. And then in the 60s, the Supreme Court said, you can't forbid people to marry just because you disapprove of them. People of different races, even prisoners, should have the right to marry. So increasingly, gays and lesbians were saying, well, gee, now you're redefining this institution in ways that applies to us. And the final, I think, change, in addition to the tremendous work of brave activists in terms of pointing out their rights and their humanness to the rest of society, but the final nail in the coffin was, again, something that heterosexuals pioneered, and that was to remove all the old laws that lasted up till the 1970s that gave men different roles, rights, and duties in marriage than women. And when we repealed those and said a marriage is an association of two individuals who can decide for themselves what they want to do, you know, well, why shouldn't it apply to gays and lesbians then?
Right.
So I think that really people have turned this around. It's the changes in heterosexual marriage that have opened the way for same-sex marriage. In turn, though, because so many heterosexuals do want egalitarian marriages, but are still struggling with a lot of old tapes and habits, like Sharon was saying earlier, same-sex marriages, which are much more egalitarian, offer the possibility of perhaps some role models for heterosexual marriages and can help us sort through some of the issues that we have in that direction.
Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. She's also the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. And Sharon Sossler is professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. This was great.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.